This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in the studio Port Townsend resident John Delaney. He's retired as a curator of historic maps at Princeton University Library. He moved out to Port Townsend, Washington following his retirement. He's traveled widely, preferring remote, natural settings, and is addicted, he says, to kayaking and hiking. In 2017, he published Waypoints with Pleasure Boat Studio in Seattle, a collection of place poems. 20 Questions, a chapbook, is recently out from Finishing Line Press. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks so much, Sheila, for inviting me, and also for so much you do here for poetry in Port Townsend. I think in my mind, you're the garrison keeler of Port Townsend.
Okay, well, I better change my venue, my show venue. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with poets and writers and publishers and editors and program directors, anyone connected to the writing life. And I like the fact that our listeners can get the behind the scenes, behind the publication idea of what's going on with writers, because the stereotype that we sit alone in our rooms or our garrets or in a coffee house.
That's not untrue.
No, it's not untrue, but it's far from just us. Mm-hmm. There's a whole village of people promoting writing so that our readers can enjoy what it is we've learned how to say. So that said, what intrigues me so much about your life in poetry is that in the 70s, as I understand it, you were in an MFA program and studied poetry. And then you took a 35-year absence and came back. So tell us about that.
Yes, there's a 35-year gap between the program I was in and publishing Waypoints, which actually is probably 40 years. The short answer is that I now have free mornings. I'm a morning person. And it's more complicated than that. In the 1970s and mid-70s, I was at Syracuse at the writing program there and was writing poems, attending workshops, reading poems, publishing poems. That's what I thought I was going to do the rest of my life. When I graduated, several of us stayed on and we taught sections of freshman English while we were trying to figure out how we were going to make a living. I got married and I decided that if I was going to continue in academia, I probably had to get a PhD and probably had to do more writing and research about other people's writing. I had always loved books and I thought, a la Philip Larkin, I don't know if you know the poet, mm-hmm. the English poet who was a librarian, I thought, gee, I could work in a library.
What an interesting influence on a career
and,
choice.
Syracuse had a wonderful information studies program, a la library science, I guess, in the old days. And I thought I would do that. So I entered into that program and got a degree in library science. After that, I thought, well, where am I going to work? And there was a one-year grant-funded position at Princeton that was being offered, and I got that, luckily, to help develop their literary manuscripts database of all things.
Wow.
Essentially indexing other people's writings in the numerous collections that they had. That developed into a 3-year National Endowment for Humanities grant to expand it to include politicians, scientists, other important figures who were distributed all over these collections, and no one knew that they were there. George Washington letters, for example, and that kind of thing. I guess I became very important to the department in terms of mining their manuscript collections. And this was before online catalogs, university library catalogs. I stayed there for those years, became a permanent librarian in rare books and special collections, the research part of the library. And when the curator of maps retired in 2000, so before that I was in charge of all the manuscripts processing people who would actually organize the manuscripts, create the finding aids, the tools that people use to discover what's in these collections, and expanding the online database. In those days, it was a mainframe. We had monitors. We had terminals connected to a mainframe, and you have to go over there and use punch cards and those kinds of things. But it developed into be 150,000 records, something like 20,000 authors represented, writers.
So I want to interrupt and ask you, did you read a lot of literature in these positions?
Well, we did. You get so involved in these collections. For example, they have the papers of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And I remember one day holding his Princeton Alumni Weekly. He followed Princeton football, and he was living with Sheila Graham out in Hollywood then. I saw this long, scraggly pencil mark across the page and realized he was taking notes with his pencil. He was reading in her apartment, the Princeton Alumni Weekly, and he had his heart attack and died. So that was the last thing he was holding, and you can see the pencil kind of mark go off the edge of the paper. Mm. It's those kind of personal things in the papers that very much affect you, I think.
When you didn't want to get a PhD because you'd have to research other people's writing, you were lucky enough to find a way to actually be in connection with their lives
amazing.
And their thoughts.
Yeah, really amazing.
Yeah.
And you saw actually the drafts of their manuscripts. Uh-huh. For him, The Great Gatsby, for example, or short stories by Hemingway, or just the correspondence, the letters.
Was part of your work to find them?
They were there. People had processed the collections, but when you go through correspondence files, you don't know necessarily who's the writer, who's the correspondent. You just find things that were missed sometimes. I found a wonderful Washington letter, I think, that had been lost. And also, trying to think what the other thing was. Oh, Robert Louis Stevenson letter.
I want to ask you, what was it like coming from writing poetry, being with a group of poets, teaching, and then here you are doing this other kind of work. Why did you stop writing as well? Just because there was too much work?
Well, I didn't stop writing. I really threw myself into life there at Princeton. I became curator of historic maps, which was gave me so much independence and flexibility. I had a pretty nice budget to buy maps and to fill in gaps in our collections. And I was always interested in travel, and the story of historic maps leads you into at least Western exploration of the Earth. I'd always been interested in visiting historical sites. And so when I did major exhibitions, I did a lot of them, I ended up writing books about the cartography of that period. So I'd got my writing fix taken care of. I also did a lot of traveling related to those exhibitions. For example, when I did one on the Northwest Passage, I wanted to take the Russian icebreaker through the Northwest Passage. When I did one on the exploration of Africa, I wanted to go to Africa.
Were these funded trips, or did you?
No.
Have...
no. Did no, you... those are my vacation trips. And so one of the most enjoyable ones was when I was doing a major exhibition on the exploration of the Pacific and Captain Cook and all that. I went to Australia and crewed on the Endeavour, which is a exact replica of the ship.
I want to ask if these expeditions and the maps and your research into, well, your happenstance of finding these amazing letters and notes in the margins, did they influence eventually the poetry that you wrote?
Places, probably. I think probably the very first poem ever written in the world was probably written about a place, something with a spiritual effect on whoever was writing it. Specific places showed up in Waypoints, I think, you know, some of the place poems that you mentioned before. I got a very good inside view on how other writers had lived their lives. Of course, a lot of them were novelists, and they got successful, and poets aren't really moneymakers. So it was very hard. I want to emphasize that all those years, it was not like I had forgotten poetry. Mm-hmm. I went to all the readings at Princeton. Elizabeth Bishop was there. I made notes. Things occurred to me. You'd write lines down. It's just that the business of writing, you know, in those days you had to type poems out and you had to send them in self-addressed stamped envelopes and wait a month. And then if they were wrinkled, you'd have to retype them. And it wasn't online multiple submission era. It was difficult. It was time-consuming. And when you're married, after dinner you don't say to everyone, well, I need to go up to my office every night and goodbye. I'll see you tomorrow. It is a solitary life. In fact, practically speaking, you need to sit in a room and be very quiet, at least I do. And I didn't have my warnings. But I did have a lot of freedom and research projects that were interesting to me and filled a career, as you mentioned, in maps and travel related to them and writing about that history.
So you come to us with an incredible literary heritage and a unique one to have been in touch with all those manuscripts and all those places. I think that you've come prepared to read from your work. Would this be a good time?
That has been a problem. Which one to read first?
How about whatever one's on top?
Okay. I'm going to read a Villanelle. I don't know how many people have read Villanelles here, but I thought it might
why don't
be interesting.
Tell us what the form is.
Well, it's rather short form of about 19 lines, and the first and third line of the first stanza repeat in subsequent stanzas. What I like about Villanelles, many readers might remember Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, or Elizabeth Bishop's One Art. The idea of it, for me, where I like it, is that it's an argument, and it's made stronger by the recurring lines. They're almost like waves. They keep coming back at you, mm-hmm. and they keep building. I've never read this poem. I've never published it, and I thought, well, why not try it today?
All right.
It's called Cremains for Joe, 1914-1999. First and oldest friend, you were my mother. What more is there to say at times like these? You loved your life, and we loved each other. Regrettably, I never met your brother, who crashed my crib once, drunk in dungarees. Oldest, you were his friend, but first, my mother. Nor did I know your parents, I gather, a lady landlocked by a captain of the seas, who loved their lives when they loved each other. After you and Dad divorced, some other woman might have fled from this heart disease, first to her oldest friends, not my mother. Such bitter sorrow never could smother your passion for projects and travel. At peace, you loved your life as you loved another. Why then to death's deafness should I bother to say anything? Just listen to me, please, to a grown man who once bounced on your knees. You're my first and oldest friend, mother. You loved your life, but we loved each other.
That is beautiful. Do you have a reason for never having sent it for publication?
Well, my mother died 20 years ago. Actually, I'm reading it because next week would have been her birthday. I probably wrote drafts of this or lines of this during that 35-year period. The benefit of a computer is that you can create and save many drafts of things. I probably have 5 or 6 versions of this.
Do you like this one the best?
So far.
It's one of the values of the computer is saving all the drafts, but if you're a sloppy record keeper, which you probably aren't from your background, it can be confusing. So I want to talk a little bit about the poem. Edward Hirsch discusses in his book, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry.
Okay.
And he discusses Elizabeth Bishop's One Art and the Villanelle. And what he says is partly what I felt listening to you. He said the Villanelle is a form that retrieves loss. It circles around loss, mm-hmm. and it retrieves it. And as full of life as the poem is, and pleasure at having had a mother who loved you, who bounced you on her knee, who gave you that legacy of enjoying one's own life despite the hardships and downturns, I feel that grief in it, and it's meaningful to me. So I want to thank you for reading
it. Very nice. Thank you. I think poems are a very good vehicle for loss. I think one of your earlier questions to me was something about many poems being somber. I don't think that's true. I think there are so many love poems and poems of jubilation. So I wouldn't say they're all somber or that's a necessary nature of poetry. But it and music, I think, probably the best vehicles for expressing grief or loss, as you said.
Well, we're going to get to your book of poems, which was the reason I asked you that question about humorous versus somber. But we'll talk about that soon.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, Sheila is speaking with Port Townsend resident John Delaney about his newest book, 20 Questions, and how he's seen poetry change since receiving his MFA in poetry in the 1970s.
Do you have another one to read?
Absolutely. This one has an epigraph. I've been writing a lot of 14-liners lately. Not necessarily sonnets. They don't all have formal structure. They don't all have that formal rhyme scheme. Some have some rhyme, some have no rhyme, but they're all 14 lines. I saw this in CNN, and I thought, geez, this is amazingly interesting, astonishing, I would say, subject for me anyway. Here's the epigraph. Scientists find perfectly preserved ancient foal in Siberia, younger than 2 weeks when it apparently drowned in mud, estimated to be 42,000 years old. The foal. The day a workman carried you out of the crater in his arms, all gangly legs, with matted hair still brown, perfectly preserved in the permafrost. It seemed that you had just been born, but not to an age tusked by woolly mammoths, nor manhandled by implements of stone. You were destined for more gallantry than that. That past has thawed. You've come into your own. The stocky Mongol horses of the steppes, the thoroughbreds of bluegrass Kentucky, and every saddled workhorse in between. If they could race with nostrils flaring back through time, their pounding hooves would herald your grand story, how you became their speed and strength and glory.
Thank you. Your poem captures the very stirring concept of seeing something that's that old and had a life.
Well, can you imagine 42,000 years? I mean,
I can't.
Think of the history of horses and human experience. What we would have done without them. Wars, transportation, workhorses. All of us seem more interested in ancestry, where we came from. To think that you could trace it back maybe to a foal of gangly legs and brown fur.
That's a very tender poem as well. Thank you for it. Do you want to read one more before we turn to your book of questions?
Okay. I'm going to read a poem about poetry. It's a very recent poem, so it's fresh.
Okay.
Top 10 reasons poems die. Some poems die on the operating table. It's a long shot, but they take the risk. Some are found where they fell off the mountain. For others, small tumors metastasize. Detected too late, they're goners. Some overdose on their own inhalations. For some, the coroner's report is inconclusive, or they go missing and are presumed dead. Others want to die, and even leave a note. Why? Born on the wrong side of the tracks, some are killed trying to cross them. Some are brain dead, so are taken off the machine. Many die of old age peacefully in their sleep, surrounded by their loved ones and flowers. They say that heart disease is number one. Reader, I'll need your CPR if I'm to survive forever.
I think only someone who writes a lot of poetry could possibly have captured the feeling of never knowing what's going on the page. Thank you.
I don't think readers understand how important they are in poetry.
Oh, yeah.
My wife says no one reads poetry anymore, but certainly so many more people are writing them, I think, than ever. Mm-hmm. And they only stay lodged in us, don't they, if you've read them and you're a reader and appreciate it.
Absolutely. And I think actually I disagree with your wife. I think more people really are reading poetry. Ever since we've had some pretty active U.S. poet laureates, there's been a lot more activity in newspapers, and they're more accessible. So fingers crossed more people are reading. Shall we turn to your new book, 20 Questions, Poems by John Delaney, published by Finishing Line Press. I have a copy of it in my hands right now. It's a beautiful book. It feels nice. The cover's lovely.
They did a very nice job, I think.
Yeah. This is a departure from the kind of poems you've been reading to us. Want to describe them?
In some ways, it's interesting to look back at 35 years. I looked at the thesis I wrote for Syracuse, which was a book of, I don't know, 50, 60 poems. And I'd say about only 4 or 5 of them had any rhyme in them. I'm coming back now after 35 years. It's like the bike was put away, and now I'm taking the rusty thing out of the garage. I was writing lines and thinking about poems all those years, but I think I use rhyme more now as a kind of comfort food. So in 20 questions, probably a much greater percentage of them have rhymed to some degree or have used rhyme throughout.
Tell us about the concept of questions in the poems.
Well, just like the book of place poems, Waypoints, I realized that I had written a lot of poems that had questions in them. For me, it would make personally a very interesting chapbook. I think poets basically are journalists. Who, what, when, where, why? And so if you're not always asking those questions when you're writing something, you're probably forgetting important parts of the issue or whatever. And that's part of the problem I have with you probably get into this, but with poems today, after 35 years, I was writing poems, and maybe we'll talk about my influences, I don't know, but back in the 70s and 80s, rhyme was not a no-no. You weren't ashamed to write something in rhyme. It seems today obscurity has taken over. I think we haven't gotten over John Ashbery, for example, and the non sequiturs of lines that don't lead from one to another. We've gotten away from the concept of line, I think.
Absolutely.
Poems were written in lines and stanzas. Today they seem to be more like sentences and paragraphs. I've seen a lot of poems where, visually too, they're redacted parts. They do that for effect, or they're grocery lists, or anything can be a poem today. And maybe that's okay. I don't know.
But in your way of thinking, what makes a poem?
Well, I think always it's not like Wordsworth said, you know, motion, recollected, and tranquility. It does involve language trying to use its tools, sounds, meaning, rhythm, to evoke some kind of response, imaginative or emotional response from a reader. I guess that's the best I can say.
I think line breaks, in my own history of learning, are very important because they stop the reader's eye at places that emphasize sound or emphasize the unit of thought in the phrase. One of the things I'm finding in poems is they end on crazy words like and, mm-hmm. of. It's as if people either aren't thinking about what the meaning of the line itself is, mm-hmm. the integrity of the line, or there's something I don't know anymore about where it's going. But I agree with you, there's been a change. But when I came to poetry, one of the things, which was in the 80s, one of the things that was remarkable to me is how hard it is actually to rhyme in the English language without sounding silly or chimey. At the back cover of your book, it says that you managed to rhyme acorn with egg-born. It takes a certain amount of originality, not only just pleasure in rhyming. You said it's comfort food, but for you. But it's there's something else going on with mm-hmm. what you're able to pull off, mm-hmm. where I think other poets avoid rhyme because they'll go for the rhymes of the inner sounds of words, mm-hmm. half rhymes, things like that, because you don't get trapped in this sing-songy thing.
I agree with that, but I think, for example, when I open the New Yorker, it seems often, I can't make a generality, but often to me it just seems prosaic. There's no rhythm, there's no music to the lines.
I'm going to confess that from the 80s on, I have never really appreciated a poem published in the New Yorker. I appreciate the articles. Uh-huh. I appreciate the stories.
And the cartoons.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But the poems right. don't make me feel most, I mean, one or two probably I've right. found, but mostly something is missing for me too, because when you say prosaic, it's not that you can't write a prose poem that has rhythm and beauty and a density of language. It's something else that's missing, ear. The poet needs to be working with mm-hmm. his or her ear. Right?
I agree. I take a kind of, we're talking about mechanics now, a kind of hook, hinge, latch approach poetry.
I'm going to write that down. Tell us what that is.
I think poems that attract me have a hook. It might just be the subject matter. That sounds interesting. You want to read it. Something in the first couple lines capture you. And somewhere in the poem, a hinge moves. The door opens to something else. The poem widens maybe or goes in a different direction, turns on a hinge. And I think to be successful, it has to have a latch at the end, some way to close that experience for the reader. In a sonnet or something like that, you have that couplet, you have a rhyme. And the rhyme, those lines function, I guess, thematically, emotionally maybe, to close it. But the rhyme helps sustain mm-hmm. that or mm-hmm. confirm that.
Right. I forgot who my teachers were quoting, but they always used to say that a famous poet, whose name I'm forgetting, would say that the poem has to lift you from a spot on the ground where you are grounded through an experience and place you back down in that place, metaphorically, but you're transformed. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something like that. I want to make sure we have a moment to hear at least one of your poems.
Okay.
And from this book.
All right. I chose one, actually, for you for that.
Good.
I originally titled it Cancer Walk, but I thought that was too limiting. You'll understand that pretty readily. It's called In Sickness and in Health. The path was wide enough for two. So side by side I walked with you, my arm around your waist. When it grew narrow, you hooked my elbow, then single file. For a while we paced. Your hand on my shoulder as we got older still felt secure as we faced the fastest future. Though we raced as fast as we could, the past grew faster. To help you stand, I grabbed your hand. When you fell behind, I chased back my steps to see. Never mind me, you said. Go ahead.
Mm. And that poem is now called
In Sickness and in Health.
And it's from your book.
Yes.
20 Questions by John Delaney. We're going to have to end soon, John. I just want to say all the poems you've read today are so touching. If that means somber to me, they're one and the same.
It's kind of like a salvage yard for me. I'm late. I'm not going to have a long career or a career actually now after all those years. But poetry has become kind of a salvage yard for me. I can salvage the places, the people, things, living or not, and thoughts that I've had and I'm having. And it's a place to find them.
I just want you to know, though, in doing that, you're offering the reader experience that hooks into their experience and their feelings and helps us all salvage. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I just want to remind listeners that you can find John Delaney's new book, 20 Questions, at finishinglinepress.com, or you can order it from our local bookstores.
Or imprint your books, yeah.
Right. So just want you to spell Delaney correctly. It's D-E-L-A-N-E-Y. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.